listening to the Survival in Motion podcast. Learn, adapt, prepare, survive.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Survival in Motion podcast. And this is author Cal Wilson. What I'm going to do on today's podcast is discuss the problem with cash. And this is something I almost talked about a few episodes ago when I was talking about surviving Dave Ramsey. But before I get to that, there are a couple of movies I wanted to talk about, hopefully pretty quickly. And I thought that it might be worth watching these two movies. They're making their way out on cable nowadays. The two movies are The Death of Stalin and Eye in the Sky. And I think if you're not too busy watching Christmas movies with your family nowadays in this season, it's probably worth watching these two movies if you see them come through your cable TV. The Death of Stalin, first. As you might know from my previous podcasts, the subject of how dictators get into power and how they stay in power and the ruthless ways they stay in power and instill fear on their own citizenry and also those around them. Those are all kind of pet subjects of mine. Not that I've formally studied them necessarily, but it's a subject that I kind of sit up and take notice when something in the news comes along along those lines. Or anything. That's the reason why I'm a staunch anti-communist or anti-collectivist, anti-socialist. And the thing about it is, it's becoming fashionable among even high schoolers, even junior high schoolers, and of course college students, to espouse this philosophy that socialism is cool, it's humane, it's a nice, just a nice philosophy, and capitalism is ruthless and cruel and mean. And that's why I think The Death of Stalin is such an educational movie to watch. And especially if you have high school and college age kids, make them sit down and watch this. Now, here's the thing. The movie starts off as kind of a very dark comedy. I know. The words comedy and Stalin were in the same sentence there. It starts off as a dark comedy and even a little bit kind of hip. And it describes briefly the state of Stalin's Soviet Union in the early 50s and just how casual midnight arrests were and how casual it was taken that somebody would be arrested and tortured and then killed. And this talk of Stalin's list of people Stalin wanted arrested and killed. And even within the inner circle of Stalin, even they felt intimidated, and with good reason. A couple of them were saying, oh, poor guy, that friend of ours, he's on the list, meaning he's going to be arrested and killed someday. And like I said, the movie starts off as kind of a hip, dark comedy, and you get the feeling that just anything goes. People were arrested and tortured and killed for just, it was so completely casual. And I think this is typical of a lot of authoritarian, well, it has been typical of authoritarian communist countries through the years. But the fact that this movie starts off as hip and as a dark comedy, I think that might keep your young high schooler or a college age son or student, it might keep them watching. And specifically, there is one woman who writes just an incendiarily hateful note to Joseph Stalin. And I think that's important because this woman in Russia is young, she's well-educated, she's articulate, she's smart, and the fact that she has such a hatred for Stalin, I think that would suck in the sympathies of high schoolers and college-age students nowadays. And they might identify with that woman. And that woman hated Stalin because Stalin arrested and killed one or more of her family members. And there was no disputing who was behind it all. And did they deserve it? Of course not. That's just how things happened in Stalin's Soviet Union. All right. Why do I think this is so important to show today's high school and college students? like I said, there's kind of this feeling, this belief that socialism and Marxism, it's just something that kind people believe. It's a philosophy that friendly people espouse, and they want to divide all the income and make sure that there are no really poor or hungry people out there. Now, this is the same philosophy and the same rhetoric that people will use to get into power. Lenin, who's a huge mass murderer, that's the language he used to get into power. And I understand that Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, he walked the walk and talked the talk of a very kind, well-meaning socialist on his way to the presidency in Venezuela. And the end result right now is the total garbage in Venezuela right now. And I'd refer you back to my podcast episode on the inside of Venezuela nowadays. But anyway, this is the rhetoric that people will use to get into power. And once they get into power, they might still keep up the rhetoric, but the end result is it winds up being just a big bloodbath of a country. And throughout the decades, who have been the biggest mass murderers in history? Well, there was Mao, who was a communist in China. There was Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union. And there was Hitler, who he might not have been communist, but he was socialist, throwing a little bit of nationalism there. There were a number of dictators in Africa who were communists. There was Kim Il-sung of North Korea back in the 50s. He killed a lot of people and had a lot of pogroms and prisoner camps throughout North Korea. He's a big mass murderer, and he was a communist, of course. But it's something that needs to be taught to our young people today, that communism and socialism are big problems, and they inevitably end up with a bloodbath in a country. Like I said, Mao, who is blamed for the death of up to 70 million people in China. There's Pol Pot, who was a communist in Cambodia, and he and his thug friends are blamed for the deaths of at least 20% of the country of Cambodia in the 1970s. And as many as one-third of the country of Cambodia died at the hands of Pol Pot. And if you make it through this movie with your high schooler or college age son or daughter, I would invite you to turn off the movie and talk to them about this. And you can list off these people who are credited or blamed with the largest death tolls in history, starting with Mao, Stalin, and Hitler, and Pol Pot, and the rest. And it's a good thing to ask them, hey, do you notice a pattern here? Do you notice a pattern of socialists and Marxists winding up in power and then killing everybody? So I think that that's an important movie to watch. And I do like the fact that it starts off as a dark comedy. Believe it or not, as I was watching this movie, there was a power struggle after the death of Stalin, and I actually found myself rooting for Khrushchev among the possible successors to Stalin. Khrushchev, yeah, that same guy who went to the UN and pounded his shoe on the podium and said, "We will bury you," that guy. I felt that that guy as a successor to Stalin was actually not as bad as the head of the secret police who was also one of the people angling to take over the Soviet Union after the death of Stalin. And that guy, spoiler alert, if you care, it was very dark comedy how that guy found himself the defendant in a very quick kangaroo trial, executed, and even his body was cremated just within the span of half an hour. It was amazing. But that's how dictatorships work. Whenever somebody dies, of course, there's a power struggle. People get killed and kangaroo trials happen. That's what happened to Ceausescu, who, of course, had it coming. But his trial was, shall we say, not the epitome of fairness and civil rights there. But he got a taste of his own medicine. All right. So that's one of the two movies I would recommend that you watch nowadays. It's The Death of Stalin. Number two, Eye in the Sky. Eye in the Sky is starring Helen Mirren, of all people, which is an interesting role for her and Alan Rickman before he passed on. It's very interesting. You hear about this drone warfare that's going on and attacks by drone aircraft with their Hellfire missile. Well, this movie kind of takes you behind the scenes, and it's really interesting how not only these drones can be in the sky miles away, but they can zoom right in on somebody. And by facial recognition technology, they can identify certain terrorists and where they are. These drones are controlled by, a lot of them are controlled by American military people in Nevada. They're like at a computer screen with a kind of a joystick, not the greatest use of words there, but... And one thing I thought was really interesting is not only the drone and how they work and how they can zoom in with their cameras and take videos and all this, but also, I didn't know this, but there are even drones that look like a little beetle. And they can make this beetle fly into an open window of a house. And the beetle will land on some rafter in the ceiling and be able to zoom in on people inside the room and also tape record. So they're videotaping and tape recording the meetings inside the house. That was amazing to me. All right. There's one part of this movie that kind of made me mad. I found myself yelling at the television. And that is this false moral dilemma that this movie presented. All right, here's the deal. We're talking about Kenya, which... Al-Shabaab is a horrible group of Muslim terrorists who have been attacking and victimizing Kenyans through the years. And there's a very sympathetic-looking teenage girl out on the sidewalk selling loaves of bread. Very sympathetic. I mean, your heart reaches out for this poor little girl on this sidewalk selling her pieces of bread. And, of course, it showed her earlier in the movie using a hula hoop in her backyard and how she's close with her parents. And, oh, it's just a very sympathetic thing. The thing is, she's selling her bread on a sidewalk right next to a terrorist safe house. And a lot of big names on the wanted list show up and they meet inside that terrorist safe house. And this is a neighborhood in Kenya pretty much controlled by Al-Shabaab. The terrorists who meet in that safe house start fitting each other with these bomb vests. And it's assumed, it's not disputed, that each one of these bomb vests, their intention is to go into a local marketplace, set off the bomb, and kill at least 80 people per bomb vest. And now that's not under dispute. That's not an argument. Now, here's what made me yell at the TV. This one American military guy at the control of the drone nearby, he was having misgivings. He was feeling, oh, I don't want to blow up that house because that sympathetic girl nearby, I don't want to have blood on my hands. And there was a woman military person sitting next to him operating something else, and she overheard this. Oh, and she was so sympathetic to this guy who did not, after all, want to have blood on his hands. I was yelling at the TV. I said, you're going to have blood on your hands either way. If you let those jihadis go with their bomb vests and kill 80 people in a marketplace at a time, guess what? That blood is going to be on your hand because you didn't want to blow up that terrorist safe house because you didn't want to kill this sympathetic girl out on the sidewalk outside. I found myself yelling at the TV. I hope that that's not what's going on behind the scenes when it comes to drone technology and drone warfare in Kenya and who knows wherever else. If terrorists who have a track record and you know who they are and you can spot them by their facial recognition technology, if they all meet in a terrorist safe house and you get one of these beetle drones that flies inside, and you can confirm that these guys are up to killing scores of innocent people in a marketplace nearby, I hope there's no hesitation. Blow up the place. End of story. Hard stop. All right? And instead, we had this American guy in the military. Oh, that girl in front. Oh, no. No, there should be no hesitation. If this is what is at stake, if these people are fitting themselves up for killing scores of people, take them out. That should be the end of it. So it's a frustrating movie to watch. It's frustrating to see this moral dilemma being chewed on by these characters. But it's very fascinating to see from the inside how drone technology works, not only that Beetle drone that I mentioned, but also the American Predator drone, how the fact that it's programmed and operated by somebody in Nevada, even though it's flying in the skies above Kenya and targeting members of Al-Shabaab. Anyway, I wanted to mention those two movies. Like I said, if you're not too busy watching Christmas movies this month, it's a good idea to watch those two movies on cable, The Death of Stalin and Eye in the Sky. Okay, now I wanted to talk about the main subject of today's episode of the podcast, and I'm entitling it The Problem with Cash. And let me just say, I first started researching this and mulling over this subject in my brain a couple months ago when I had that podcast episode on Dave Ramsey, and I entitled it Surviving Dave Ramsey. And it was my conclusions and thoughts and opinions based upon having taken the Financial Peace University class offered by Dave Ramsey twice. And there was one part of my outline that the more I worked on it, the more I thought it over, the more I thought, no, that's just too big of a subject to bring up. And I'll just make that its own episode. And that is the use of large amounts of cash, not only in saving large amounts of cash to spend, but also using large amounts of cash to actually spend and buy things. And that's something that Dave Ramsey advocated several times in the Financial Peace University. I have a problem with that, and I'll get to it later. Let me just start off by saying, as a disclaimer, I'm not providing legal, I'm not providing accounting advice. And for that specific advice, you should talk to an attorney about your specific issue or an accountant for your specific issue. And that's not just a throwaway line. I'm being serious about it. I'm just giving information and education here. I'm not interpreting the laws I'll be discussing with your personal situation. That's what legal advice is, or accounting advice. For that, go to a lawyer or a CPA. And also, when it comes to hiring a lawyer, quote unquote, I guess I've touched on this before, but let me explain it. It's actually not as expensive as you might think. Most counties in the United States have a bar association. That's kind of a club of the local lawyers. Not every lawyer in the county has to join it, but a lot of them do. And most bar associations have a lawyer referral service. So wherever you live, you can Google your county name and then bar association. And chances are you'll get a link to a website for the local bar association. And a lot of bar associations will have a lawyer referral service where you can call up and request to meet with a lawyer on the subject you're interested in, either half an hour for free or half an hour for $50, 45 minutes or whatever. It's not as expensive as you might think. And that's a chance for you to talk to a lawyer about whatever subject is important to you and pay little or nothing for that time of that lawyer. Now, of course, a lot of times people meet with a lawyer in this circumstance and it winds up being kind of, you know, a promotion thing. That's something that if it happens, you're just going to have to sit through it. But you can ask a lawyer, here's my situation, what do you think? And that's when you'll get specific legal advice specifically on your situation. And it's supposed to be confidential. The only thing that's not confidential when you're talking to a lawyer is when there's a discussion of harming somebody else or killing somebody else. That's not confidential. But everything else is confidential when you talk to an attorney. And of course, the attorney is not supposed to advise you on how to break the law. The attorney is supposed to advise you on how to come in compliance and follow the law. So there's that other caveat there. So anyway, I'm not giving legal advice here. I'm not giving accounting advice here. Okay. And I did mention the context of this is Dave Ramsey and his discussion of using cash either to save or spend and buy a car specifically or a house. And he never specifically talked about saving cash above $10,000. But that's kind of a threshold there. Not all the laws that I've researched have that threshold, $10,000. Some laws out there have a threshold of $2,000 to $3,000. So anyway, let me talk to you about why it's a problem to save up and to use that much cash at a time. And also, I wanted to say, it's relevant in a prepper podcast like this, because let's face it, survivalists and preppers will tend to have more currency saved up than the average man or woman on the street. So I think it's relevant to discuss this in a prepper podcast. Anyway, the first problem with cash has to do with inflation. Way back whenever cash first was invented, it's something that helps an economy. Instead of everything being barter, somebody way back when decided, hey, let's have a coin or let's have a bill that says a dollar or a lira or a peso or whatever. Way back when. And it actually does help the economy, because if everybody respects that currency and everybody realizes it has a value to it, then instead of having to bring something to barter when you want to buy a good or service, you just bring some of that currency with you or coins with you. On the other hand, the problem with holding on to stuff like that for a long time is inflation. And here in the United States, we haven't had a real serious inflation for a couple of decades. I remember back, I think it was in the Carter administration, we had a quarterly rate of inflation close to 20%. It was ridiculous. And then Reagan supposedly got it under control down to 6% at one point. And since then, it's been like 2 to 3% every year. But even that's bad enough. So in other words, if you save $100 right now, a year from now, it's only going to be worth $97. And then after that comes another 3%. So whatever the inflation rate is, that's your negative return every year. So it is a depreciating asset on an annual basis. So there's that problem. Some countries in the world, their powers that be who man the printing presses have gotten carried away. And inflation, like for example, in Venezuela, several thousand percent a year. You know, different countries all over the place are always having horrible inflation rates. All right, here's the second problem with cash. And what I'm going to be talking about is a series of laws that come from the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970, the Patriot Act, and one specific code section is 31 U.S. Code Section 5324. It has to do with structuring. All right, here's the deal. For a long time, it's been the rule that when you cross a international border, you have to declare if you are carrying $10,000 or more. Some international borders have a lot lower amount that you have to declare. But by and large, with the United States, if you leave or if you come in and you're carrying $10,000 in cash, you have to fill out a form and declare it. All right, here's another issue with cash. Depositing into a bank or withdrawing from a bank $10,000 or more will result in the bank filing what's known as a currency transaction report. And I'm not going to get into all the twists and turns. You know, what happens if it's a bank account with you and your wife and you deposit $6,000 in the morning, your wife deposits $5,500 right before closing or whatever. There's a bunch of different issues. But the point is, there's something called a currency transaction report that the bank will file whenever you do this. And you might think, it's none of your damn business what I do with my own money. Well, we're kind of beyond that point at this point. Like it or not, because of the laws, the Patriot Act especially, that claims to be something that will prevent people from financing terrorism. There's also something on the currency transaction report called an SAR, Suspicious Activity Report, and that's something that they can also report on you if you take in or withdraw $10,000 at a time from the bank. All right, here's something else to keep in mind. If there's a private transaction with a trade or business of $10,000 or more, then that business has to file what's known as a Form 8300 with the IRS. And you can look up that form on the internet and you'll get a feel for what they're looking for. It's not just cash or coins. It's traveler's checks, cashier's checks, money orders, bank drafts. I think that was it. All of this totals up to more than $10,000, then somebody's going to have to file a Form 8300 with your name as the purchaser and your taxpayer ID number, which essentially means your Social Security number. What happens after this is filed and you pay $12,000 for, I don't know, an ATV or something, and the person who sold it to you gets your name and Social Security, and they file one of these 8300 forms with your name and Social Security? What my research has almost universally told me is that nothing will happen. All the IRS is looking for is a pattern. Now, if you totally believe that, I have some land to sell you when the tide goes out. I can practically quote a CPA I dealt with a couple years ago who told me, and he used to work at the IRS. The IRS is a very big organization, and one part of the IRS does not necessarily know what the other part of the IRS is up to at any given time. It's also a very arbitrary organization. It's a very unpredictable organization. So here's my theory, and maybe this is me just being paranoid, but when it comes to Form 8300 and supposedly the IRS doesn't care, what happens in this situation? The IRS is looking for somebody to audit, and they narrow it down to you and several other people, all of whom have similar tax filings in the past, and they're looking into doing just a drop-dead body cavity-type audit. Excuse the crass metaphor there, but I mean, one of these horrible audits, and they've narrowed it down to several people there with similar financial filings in the past. And one of those people has a Form 8300 on file. In my opinion, the IRS will be more likely to audit that person instead of the other people, all other things being equal. So that's why I think the Form 8300, even though it's routinely talked about as no big deal, I think it could be a big deal just by that theory myself. Point is, the IRS is notified that you've spent that much cash or money order or whatever on some transaction. So I think the audit risk is greater whenever there are 83 form filings or also a CTR. All right. You might say, well, okay, maybe I should take out less than $10,000 at a time from my bank and then come back a few hours later or the next day or something. That's called structuring. And if you Google the term structuring and IRS or Google structuring and CTR or 8300 or whatever, you'll get a feel for what they're looking for. So in other words, it's not just the $10,000 threshold. Sometimes you can be suspected of doing something wrong, and you're dealing with less than $10,000 at a time. And this is illegal, and that was the U.S. code section I mentioned above. One prime person who got snagged under the law against structuring was former Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, who, as you might recall, was being blackmailed by somebody he had some dealings with back when he was a high school coach. And he was actually paying that person cash, but it involved taking a whole lot of cash withdrawals from his bank account. And after being confronted, then he started taking less than $10,000 at a time. And that's when he was charged with structuring. So keep that in mind. Structuring and the 8300 CTR and all this, and they both have SAR possibilities where, I don't know, if you come in and you look like you're doing something suspicious and possible criminal activity, and you deposit $9,000 or something, they can check that box that says this is suspicious activity. You know, if you're wearing a big floppy hat and a fur overcoat or something, they might suspect you're a pimp or whatever. That's a stereotype, I know. But keep that in mind. Here's the thing, though. The IRS has a small part of their website that it will explain the Form 8300 to you. And you can read through it. And look, I'm going to put this link on the show notes here at this podcast. I personally take that with a grain of salt because here's my experience. I looked at Form 8300, and You know, as you look through a tax form, you kind of get a feel for what the rules are. Okay, this is what they're looking for. And then I read the explanation part of that website, and it gives several examples. And a couple of these examples, I looked at them, I said, no, that doesn't make sense. So in my opinion, the link I'm going to give you might be just muddying the waters. It might be confusing you. But some of those examples, I honestly don't think that they're right. Although the IRS is presenting these examples, so I guess you have to go with them. But what I'm leading up to is this. Dealing with a whole big wads of cash in today's society is problematic. It's not automatically problematic, but it can be. If you deal with your financial dealings in such a way so as not to be snagged by these rules, good for you. If you comply with the law and you set things up so that you are following the law and you are not in violation of these rules, good for you. But what happens when you're dealing with a $10,000 or more transaction with somebody who's not a trade or business, which does not require filing Form 8300, but that person goes and deposits that money into their bank account, and then they get a call from somebody in the government, and they say, oh, don't look at me. I just got that cash from that guy. And it's a problem. There's no way to completely insulate yourself from these rules when you're dealing with big, huge wads of cash. And I'm talking mostly $10,000 or more, but some of these rules involve less than $10,000. So there you have it. Not an exhaustive discussion, but a discussion on the possible problems with cash, not only inflation, but also on the reporting that accompanies cash withdrawals, deposits, or transactions. And this is not even meant to be an exhaustive discussion on all of the reporting issues that involve cash. Like I said, $10,000 is the usual threshold, but reporting happens for amounts less than $10,000. I definitely recommend that you set up your financial affairs so as to follow the laws and rules out there that concern currency. And currency includes dollar bills, coins, money orders, cashier's checks, traveler's checks, bank drafts, and also foreign currency. Of course, part of following the law on all this is to know what the law is. So I will post links in the show notes that'll help you educate yourself on what the applicable laws are in this subject. One other topic I want to touch on briefly, and I know we have some international listeners, is this. What I discussed today has to do with the United States only, but foreign countries also have currency restrictions as well, just in different ways and for different threshold amounts. But I hope this has educated you so that you know at least there's an issue there. I don't know where to advise you on how to look it up, but you know that there's an issue, so you can probably look it up and educate yourself on that as well, even if you live outside of the United States. But no matter where you live, whether it's in the United States or elsewhere, if I can leave you with one thought from this discussion, one thing to take away from this episode of the podcast, it's this. Storing and using big piles of cash, especially $10,000 or more, may be problematic. I'm not saying it's illegal necessarily, but it may be problematic. That's all. And when someone knowledgeable on financial matters like Dave Ramsey suggests saving up and spending cash for cars or houses, you know, using physical cash, an alarm bell should go off in the back of your head. Hey, this is a potential problem. Your brain should be telling you. You know, again, not necessarily illegal, but reporting will happen and it's possibly problematic. And as a financial guy, I think Dave Ramsey has to know this. And I feel like his Financial Peace University should at least have like an asterisk or something in the course material that points you in the direction of knowing that there could be issues or at least some kind of reporting on large cash transactions. That's all. I think his class is lacking in that respect when it discusses so much of this saving cash and spending cash on larger items. You know, a refrigerator is one thing, but a car or a house is another. Anyway, I hope you found today's episode of the Survival in Motion podcast educational and informative. And remember, I'm not giving you legal or accounting advice. I hear the music. That means our time is up. Thanks for joining me. God bless.